Talk given Saturday, 6th December 1975. Each and every one of us is a congeries of energies, of what energies? We may put it in a single term and call it primordial transcendent energy. Now we have to try and understand the significance of a statement like that. The one total reality, the whole universe, what is known of it, what we have still to discover of it, is the manifestation of this single total reality which manifests this primordial creative energy in action. So, we may put it this way, that each one of us is the embodiment of transcendence itself. There is no difference in terms of ultimate reality between the individual and the totality, except that each individual person, like every single object that there is in this universe, manifests the unbelievable variety in which that one energy manifests itself. As such, each one of us, to confine ourselves to mankind, each one of us is a unique individual. Unique in the sense that he is an expression of transcendence which displays the beauty and the perfection, the marvel and the wonder of transcendence in a specific form. And still more than that, that specific form is not a static, fixed form. It is not a tomb of the eternal life. We are living forms, continuously changing forms. And we can make that change, a change from one state of beauty to another state of beauty, or what we commonly call the harsh reality of life, a descent into misery, pain, sorrow, ugliness, and so on. That is our personal responsibility. But we have to wake up to the fact that each one of us as an individual is transcendence embodied. And this fundamental transcendent energy shows itself in various forms of energy through each of us. Now we all know that none of us is perfect. What is it that distorts, that spoils this utter beauty of transcendence in us. Something interferes with what would be a divine process, unsullied. Specifically, desire, our own desires. The desire drive in us is confined to our animal level, confined to our animal level. It expresses itself in a form which is not the perfect form of the desire drive as expressed in the actual animal. In us, it expresses itself in a subhuman form. We are the only creatures capable of deliberate evil, conscious, knowing, deliberate cruelty, deliberate untruthfulness, dishonesty, and so on. This is what interferes with our living process, which is a growing process, remember. Our growth is to be understood not merely in terms of the maturing of the body or in terms of the acquisition of virtues, as we call them, or the acquisition of knowledge, as we understand knowledge today. It is not to be seen in that light. It is best seen as the emergence of the continual and whole awareness of the reality, the fact that we are transcendence embodied. Now, it is because most of our life, through most of our life, we are unaware of this fact that we descend to the subhuman level. We sink into the mire, to use an ordinary phrase. You remember how in Genesis it is said that the Lord God was walking in the garden in the cool of the evening, and he asks Adam, "Where art thou?" Do you think he was inquiring whether Adam had gone to sleep or whether he was cooking or anything like that? The Lord God has better business than to inquire after such things. The question implies at what level of consciousness am I? Because the story of Adam and Eve is repeated through all time as long as there is mankind on the face of the globe. You and I are Adam and Eve. At what level is our awareness? Now, let's go back to this animal drive in us. And desire, which we human beings experience, always finds an impure form of expression because it is in conflict with that something else which is emerging out of us. The good animal lives wholly as the good animal, obedient to the laws of its being, unconsciously so. We have to grow to full consciousness. The little spark, the little light within the darkness has to burst into full flame and light up the total darkness. So you see, in addition to what happens in the animal world, in the human world, something else is happening. We talk about these things, the intellect gives assent to it, but it is superficial. It's only a superficial assent. We don't really wake up to it. If we really woke up to it, that is the end of all conflict, of all evil in our lives. Then we are wholly and fully human. There are those who aspire to this, thousands of them. But why doesn't that aspiration come to full flower? Primarily because the intellect, which to start with is the slave of desire, is conditioned right from the time we are born, and therefore it makes specific pictures of the ought to be in terms of mind, character, consciousness, and so on. It postulates all kinds of unwarrantable things. It just imposes these pictures. We as individuals forget that at any stage of our life, we cannot say what we ought to become. Take the body itself. I am born, I'm a little child. Can I lay down as an infant just how and into what this body shall grow? I have not the least idea. Look at the pictures which we sometimes see of men soon after birth, 3 years of age, 7 years of age, in their teens, as adults, as middle-aged people, as old people, and look at the difference. Now, could that person in here, when he was three or whatever age you like to start at, could he have said, this body shall grow into such and such a shape and appearance? It's totally impossible. What brings that body to the appearance that it has in its middle age and its old age? The living process, which is the unknown, its life, the unknown, the mystery, which does it. And it is the same with mind and character and your mode of awareness. The intellect cannot lay down the ought to be, and yet that is precisely what we all do. And we all do that because our natural urges within us are ill understood, and therefore they are ill expressed. We never try to understand the natural urges which are concerned with the perpetuation of the body, eating, drinking, and so forth come into it, exercise, systems of physical fitness, and so forth, work, play, all that comes into it. And in addition to that, there is the process of the growth, the natural growth of the mind. We do not have a natural growth of the mind. It is conditioned all the time. We don't allow the mind to grow. In order to allow the mind to grow, it is essential to be attentive to whatsoever is happening around us without giving it an interpretation in accordance with our previous knowledge. This is what stops the growth of the mind. So you see, because of this conditioning, there is a state of conflict. We will say, let us get rid of the conditioning. We cannot deliberately get rid of the conditioning. To get rid of it, the desire to get rid of it, is a mistake. We have to learn the truth about ourselves by observing this conditioning. It's no good automatically saying, oh, this is a conditioned reaction or some such thing. All right, having said it, am I free from the limitations it imposes upon me? I can't throw it out of the window. What can I do? How can I transform that conditioning of the mind? Remember what we started with? We are a congeries of energies. This energy expressed, which is expressing itself as an ill state, a diseased state of the mind, cannot be thrown out. It is me. I have to transform it. I have to heal it. Now, I've deliberately put it in the wrong way. I have to transform it and heal it. I have to allow it to get transformed. It will transform itself if I just observe and fully understand it. If I fully understand it, then what I do is to present the conditions in which life will effect the transformation. What is it that heals? Nature heals. Life heals. See, these are the things we forget. And therefore, we exchange one ill state for another ill state. You may say, but this is terrible. It makes everything seem utterly hopeless. What's the good of trying to do anything? Of course, don't try to do it, let it happen. It will happen. Can you stop the life process? The living process is going on all the time. Whether I do anything about it, as I say, or whether I don't do anything about it. You will ask then, where does action come in? Action is total action, and total action starts with being fully aware of what is actually present and then observing it very, very intensely. In the process of that observation, not only the mental phenomenon of observation, but the physical phenomenon of bodily action will accompany it. Not necessarily always, because it may not need any bodily action. This is the point. The transformation of the mind, the healing of the mind, the whole making and the maturing of the mind, therefore, takes place by allowing it to happen without interfering with it through the idea that I've got to do something about it. You know, this is where our intellect is a misfortune in some ways. Because it inhibits our profounder mental and psychical sensitivities. Now, I don't want you to run away with the idea, therefore, that we should just follow our feelings. Our feelings, in the ordinary way, are as deceptive as our intellect. Just be quiet and observant, because in that quietness and in that state of complete observation, one's sensitivity, inner sensitivity to the true nature of things comes into play. And when that comes into play, thought, feeling, and physical action which follow will be the right sort of thought, feeling, and physical action. This is a very difficult matter. It is not easy to understand, still more difficult to explain. Hold on to the central point again. We are a congeries of energies. We are transcendence embodied. I spoke a few minutes ago about the animal urge and the animal drive, which is concerned with the preservation of the self. Body and keeping body and soul together. Food, drink, etc., sex, which keeps the species going, and as the counterpart of that, there is the other aspect, namely the aspiration of the individual and the growth in terms of mind and consciousness to full awareness of one's relationship with the what we call the environment, the totality. This is the, if you like, the spiritual aspect of it. What happens with the ordinary material aspect, the aspect of just living? We are drawing the world unto ourselves. And we function, that is to say, the mass of mankind functions almost exclusively in that manner all its life, drawing the world unto oneself. But this self-centered living is the source of conflict between man and man, and between man and his environment. Because what I want to draw to myself, driven as I am by my imperfect state, is not the same as what anybody else wants. it is different. So there is conflict because of difference. And there is conflict also because it is the same. Two men want the same girl, or vice versa. Two girls quarrel over the same man. So there you are. That is the animal aspect. This other aspect is the aspect which is not self-centered, which does not isolate oneself from the totality. But the self-consciousness recedes into the background. The us-consciousness comes into the foreground. One is aware in terms of the totality. To use Christian terminology, thy will, O Lord, not mine. You can interpret this in terms of yogic symbolism. You all know we talk about the seven chakras. The middle one is the one at the heart center, as it is called, anahata. And there are the three lower centers, which are concerned with food, sex, and everyday, and the commerce of everyday life. The three higher centers are concerned with the spiritual life, which is a going into the inner depths of the mind, and by awakening fully to those inner depths, becoming aware in terms of totality. One can't become aware in terms of totality in the physical sense. Neither you nor I will ever know what's going on the planet Mercury or some distant galaxy or something. We can only be conscious of our environment as such. So to that extent, we become aware of the totality. Now, these lower three centers meet the upper three centers at the heart center, anahata, which is the level of humanity, not of subhumanity. The energies, the different forms of energy, of the one transcendent energy, which are concerned with the perpetuation of the individual self, Mooladhara, Swadhisthana, Manipura, meet the other energies of transcendence, Vishuddhi at the throat center, Ajneyar at the eye center, and Sahasrara at the brain, which are the transcendent expressions of the energy of transcendence. And they meet here at the heart center. If the passage through the heart center, upwards and downwards, is a free passage, then transcendence is in charge of your whole being. It transcendentalizes what we call the three lower centers. If it transcendentalizes the three lower centers, it means that the sources of conflict born of separative consciousness, which belong to the three lower centers, that conflict is out, that separative consciousness is transformed, has completely changed into the consciousness of totality, the us consciousness. Therefore, one never thinks, feels, and acts for oneself. One thinks, feels, and acts for everything, for everybody. Now, where that is the case, one is in harmony with everybody. That harmony is fundamentally expressed by the fact that oneself never harms anybody. One is harmless to anybody and everybody. Other bodies may call themselves one's friend or one's enemy, but oneself knows no distinction between friend and foe. They are all part of one total reality. Now, the question arises, how does one enable this free passage at the heart center to take place? Don't think that any sort of postures or breathing exercises or anything like that will do it. This is a symbolic system. All these systems are just symbolical ways of talking, of a process which goes on in the deeps of the mind. And the mind is spaceless, timeless, formless, shapeless. Therefore, there is no such thing as higher and lower and something at the heart and something at the base and something at the head and so forth. Be extremely sensible about all these things. It is convenient to talk in these terms. That is why these different systems are invented. It is a convenient way of talking. So now, how do we enable this to take place? By complete attention. If in trying to attend, one is conscious of oneself attending to an other, that is not attention in the religious sense, in the true yogic sense, in the transcendental sense. That is not attention. If whilst one is observing, the brain is chattering back at every single thing that is observed, passing judgments, making pronouncements, experiencing aversions or approvals and all the rest of it, then that is not attention. That is to say, it is attention in the commoner garden sense, which belongs to this sphere of conflict and of the ill state. But it isn't attention in the fully human sense, the fully human sense, which is the divine sense, because the full human is the divine embodied. It is not attention in the fully human sense. It is not attentiveness per se. So you see, the discipline of the religious life consists in being constantly aware of the nature of this attentiveness. And as one is really aware of the nature of that attentiveness, then all its ill expressions become transformed by life the healer, by transcendence which continuously makes whole. How is it that a living cell, for instance, has this extraordinary power of self-healing? It just happens. I don't know how, and I don't suppose anybody else, or at least most other elses, know how it happens. We don't know. This is something outside our ken. It's a mystery. All that we can know is just this little bit, which is our special task, to be attentive in this completely transpersonal manner. It's neither personal nor impersonal. One may say, oh, I'm a scientifically trained person and I observe objectively. Our dear scientists are a little bit misled when they say that. No less a scientist than Eddington, Sir Arthur Eddington, pointed out very clearly in his Tanner lectures of 1938 that scientists who believe that they are observing objectively, purely objectively, are not doing so. They are observing, looking in a manner in which they are looking for the evidence which will support their hunch. It's not a totally free from self-observation. This is what we have to do. This is the very heart of the whole discipline of the religious life. This attending in this way. And then that aspect of energy which is transcendence itself comes to play. Reverting to our yogic symbolism. The three upper centers are able to find free access through the heart center right down to the other three centers. Consider carefully, if they are transcendentalized, all the struggle, the conflict, the evil, the anxiety, the misery concerned with food and sex completely vanish. This is a simple fact. A fact almost impossibly difficult to appreciate and understand. But there it is. There is the key to liberation for the individual. Some of you have heard it said, this is what they say in India, that the physical heart is on the left side of the body, the spiritual heart is on the right side. Now the statement as it stands, if we look at it literally, is utterly nonsensical. It was their miserable trick to keep that knowledge esoteric, hidden. What is this heart which is on the right side? The word for heart is hridaya. Now hridaya, its first and simple meaning, of course, is the physical heart. This physical organ inside the living body. The other meaning of hridaya is the essence, the very core, the mysterious, invisible, ungraspable center of the mind, the spirit, the best, the perfect, and so on and so on. This is the meaning of hridaya. And this is the meaning of hridaya that one should take as the first meaning when one comes across the word heart in all the scriptures of the world. Now, consider another point. Matters spiritual are, every one of them is rooted somewhere, somehow, in this living material body. That is why the particular symbolic associations of the different yogic centers with different parts of the body has some meaning, has some significance. Modern scientific research is at last showing that the right side of the brain has an unusual function. It is concerned with things transcendent. It's only quite recently that we are discovering these things scientifically. Now, Hridaya, the mind. Can you imagine a mind functioning in a body which had no brain? A totally brainless body? Will it display any mental function, assuming that such a body could be alive at all? So you see, those people knew it somehow. There is an association. The spiritual Hridaya, they said, is on the right side. But that is merely the concrete anchor, so to say. The concrete soil, the right side of the brain, is the concrete soil which is essential for all our spiritual functioning. When this transcendentalizing process takes place, then, that side of the brain is active. And the whole nervous system undergoes a great transformation. Note how, even if a person is extraordinarily tired or frail in body or sick or nearing death, when it comes to a case of him, assuming that he has realized holiness, when it comes to a case of functioning as the Holy One in relationship to others, he is full of energy and power right to the end. There is no flagging. There is extraordinary energy. We see it in other fields too. Take great art. That's one of the very fine fields where beauty is made manifest. Your composer, your poet, he may be physically a wreck, near death, but when this thing functions, perfection comes out, beauty comes out. And they call it the triumph of mind over matter. That is rather an unfortunate way of putting it, because it is egoistically subhuman. I have conquered this, that, or the other. What utter nonsense. It has happened that way in order that the marvel and the glory of transcendence may be manifest. And it completely defeats all our beliefs and our particular explanations and all the rest of it. And it is good to know that it does that, because then I come to know I am as nothing at all. And I also know that because I, as an I, a separate I, am nothing, therefore transcendence itself can function fully through me. Now, does not this relate to the mode of attentiveness? To the manner in which one is attentive? If one is attentive in the pure sense, free of I-ness in any shape or form, then transcendence functions through you without your knowing it. Without your neighbor knowing it, unless he is the perfected Holy One and is sensitive and he sees. Afterwards, you may come to know. Afterwards, it is as if you come out of that heavenly state back to the earth state, earthy state. And something stirs in this top story here, this little brain, and concepts and words present a picture of which is something like what actually took place. Now, once again, bear in mind that all this is a symbolic way of talking, all these centers and so forth. We talk of the seven centers in terms of Indian yoga. But the seventh center, the Sahasrara, itself has six centers of its own. You know how they always talk in terms of sevens in the scriptures. They are very fond of talking of sevens. There's a very interesting little passage in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad about seven seers sitting upon the rim of the bowl. And how is the Sahasrara center presented? Like a lotus flower, a fully open lotus flower. And there are the seven perfected holy ones sitting on the seven petals. I don't know exactly how many petals a lotus flower has, but for this purpose it has seven petals. And they associate each of the petals with each of the stars of the Great Bear. You see how those old people drove a man's intellect. They sent his intellect helter-skelter here, helter-skelter there, on all sorts of false scents, false trails, until finally, if he really meant business, he began to perceive the nature of this training and the nature of this discipline. And having roamed through the universe, hence the seven stars of the Great Bear, that's far enough away for us, you see, he came back home to his own eternal home, which, whilst he's alive, is in his heart. Heart in both senses. Thus, here and in terms of the mind. And when he came back home, he came back having dropped forever his I am I, separative consciousness. And he realized then, indeed, this is no other than transcendence embodied. And the law of transcendence is the law of nothing for self. Nothing to be grasped for self. And in realizing that law, what actually happens in manifestation is that everything which is perfect and beautiful and right and proper comes unto that self and goes out freely, a benediction upon his environment. When this happens, an extraordinary, several extraordinary things happen to the individual. There is a wonderful indifference released to anything and everything that happens to him. He doesn't have to make any deliberate effort to renounce or to relinquish this, that, or the other. Self-sacrifice has no meaning for him anymore in the sense that it has meaning for the worldling. He is naturally a perpetual self-sacrifice, and he's utterly unconcerned with himself. He neither clings to life, nor does he precipitate death. If he is ill, he doesn't want to be rid of the illness. He observes what is happening and learns the lesson out of it in the immediate moment. He is in tune with the entire life process as such. So there is this remarkable indifference, upeksha, upekha of the Buddha. So its very first literal meaning of indifference is also fulfilled in his teaching. And remember that upekha in the Buddha's teaching is the apex, the peak, the crowning point of the manner in which he presents love, his teaching of love, which embraces, as you know, friendliness, loving kindness, one, compassion, two, sympathetic joy, happiness in the spiritual growth and welfare of all others. And finally, this word upekkha, this utter indifference. Look at the other meaning of it. Equanimity. Absolute equanimity. What is this equanimity? This equanimity is not indifference. It is total and complete sensitivity to the state of the world as it is, but the individual himself is in permanent poise. A poise which is dynamic. It's a quivering here now, a vibrating here now, in complete sympathy with the totality and all its suffering. Therefore, out of such an individual, there emerges compassion, wisdom, the vision of the truth of things as they are, all goodness, all virtue, quite naturally and spontaneously, and utter beauty. It is one of the wonderful things about human beings who are artists that they have always portrayed the holy ones as being utterly beautiful. Utterly beautiful. In actual fact, they probably were just as ugly as I am or anybody else is. But the artist always portrays the perfected Holy One as beautiful, because the artist is sensitive enough to know, to feel, that transcendent beauty has at last come to full flower in man, each individual man. And so, the fact that each one of us is a center of energies, is a congeries of energies, is a center from into whom transcendent energies enter and out of whom transcendent energies radiate. That is realized, made real by him who truly lives the religious life.